Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This program is for all you parents out there and grandparents. It's how to raise a healthy child from the standpoint of, and this is a unique perspective, their microbiome. We're talking to an expert researcher in this field. She's Dr. Marie-Claire Arrieta, and she is located up in at the University of Calgary, beautiful part of the world, in the province of Alberta. And she focuses on research related to intestinal bacterial species and their relationship to health. And, in addition, she's the mom of two young children, so she's got practical experience in this field. So, Dr. Ayer, you know, you're doing all this academic research, you're steeped in the scientific literature. How does that translate in terms of practical recommendations for the way you raised your kids? What do you suggest that parents do to cultivate kids' healthy microbiomes?
Well, there's lots of things that we can do, fortunately, and the important is to learn more about microbes, to understand how they work, and as much as we can, what we know of the ones that are associated with health. The important thing is to start early, and so ideally this is something that you read upon or learn upon before birth. Not to say that it's not beneficial to start at any time, including, you know, when you're a grown up, it's always important to take care of your gut microbes. But yes, if you can, I mean, start from birth, if at all possible, you know, vaginal delivery, it's great. It really will translate into you delivering not just your baby, but transferring all these great gut microbes.
Right. It's really worth a try. And you know, sometimes, doctors may be accused of excess caution, or maybe for the sake of convenience, they want to, you know, set the time of delivery, and maybe they give up a little bit too early. I mean, there's situations, of course, where it's absolutely mandatory for the safety of the child and the mother, but
of course,
you know. But let's kind of, you know, push back against that. And then there's also what's called VBAC, which means that once you've had a C-section, you actually don't have to give it up. You can actually deliver vaginally afterwards. That would be preferable.
Yes, exactly. And of course, this is a case-by-case scenario. It really depends on your person. And at the end of the day, this is very much a personal decision. The last thing I want to do is to tell someone, you should be doing this or right. that. But what we can do as, you know, scientists in this field is to provide people with information. And there is really good science that supports the advantages of transmitting your vaginal and fecal microbe to your baby at birth. So that would be the first thing that you can do. And then after that, breastfeeding, which is not easy. I remember when it came to mm-hmm. my babies, I was lucky that I was able to breastfeed both of mine extensively, but it was not easy. And that's one of the first things that I think women should be told, but is great. Breastfeeding is this really, I don't really believe in superfoods, but if there is one superfood, it is breast milk. It is alive in the sense that it has cells in it. It actually has bacteria in it. It's not sterile. And one of the cool, really cool facts about breastfeeding is that it has a carbohydrate component that cannot be digested by human enzymes. It can only be digested by your microbiome.
So literally, you're not just feeding your child, you're deliberately feeding and encouraging a healthy microbiome, priming the growth of good bacteria.
Exactly. And if you think about the evolutionary design of a substance like breast milk after, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years, the fact that about 10% of breast milk is not even digestible for humans, but it is digestible for the microbiome really speaks a lot about how important this relationship is. So breastfeeding is, for a number of reasons, and now including another one, the microbiome, it's one of the best things that you can do for your baby and the microbes of your baby. Then, you know, when it comes to introduction of foods, and we were alluding to it when we were talking about introduction of allergenic foods, but yes, introducing high fibrous foods and variety of fibers, and to do that, you know, constantly and throughout the day, including, you know, snacks and breakfast and so on. And then from then, I think to avoid what we call the hyper-hygienic practices, to, you know, lose this idea that you have to have a hand sanitizing gel to sterilize your hands or your baby's hands every time he or she decides to put something in the mouth and so on, to just let go of this thought that we have to be clean at all times.
So there seem to be bad for several reasons. One is that, you know, they don't allow for the hygiene hypothesis to take its effect, normal bacterial colonization, but they also seem to create bacterial resistance. And at the same time, there may be chemicals in these products which are endocrine disruptors, gender benders. Right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they're not that safe to use. And triclosan is the one that comes to mind. The FDA just changed some of its recommendations when it comes to triclosan, but you still find it everywhere. I mean, from deodorant to toothpaste, and it's just added to everything. And the fact of the matter is that this notion that products, cleaning products or personal use products, they have to be antimicrobial is almost as it is actually a marketing strategy. If you put the word antimicrobial, that will sell more because people want that to feel that you are, you know, getting rid of microbes.
There's also some evidence. I've seen studies which suggest that kids who grow up on farms, where they have exposure to farm animals and barns and probably animal poop, because that's one of the chores that farm kids get to do, is clean out the chicken coop, clean out the cow shed, that they actually have a reduced incidence of certain allergic diseases. Is that true?
Yes, that is correct. And it's been done in farms around the world. I mean, European farms and North American farms too. And the evidence is just so sound. And to me, one of the studies that really brought it home was when they compared two farming communities. They compare the Amish to the Hutterites. So these communities, they have a very similar ancestry. They come from Austria, I believe. So genetic differences are very, very small. And they're, you know, they live quite simple lives, and they large places, multi-family homes or farms, I should say, and their life is farming. This is what they do. But the main difference is that the Hutterites, they have adopted modern farming practices. They have tractors, and they have, you know, everything that a modern farm uses. And they use antibiotics in their feeds, which is something that modern agriculture does. But the Amish don't. They still farm the same way that they farmed about 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the interesting part is that the Hutterite children, they have a much higher risk of developing allergies and asthma than the Amish kids. So it really has to do, and then there's other additional studies that they have found they actually have found bacterial components, not just in the outside part of the farms, but in the bedding, so where these people actually sleep, and they have shown that just the dust in the homes, it's protective of allergic responses in cells, for example. So it is a very different environment to grow with, and of course by modernizing our lives, we are removing ourselves from that.
On a more consequential level, it has been said, and I know that these studies are controversial, that the Amish enjoy some degree of protection, not complete immunity, but some degree of protection from autistic spectrum disorder or autism.
Yes.
And
that true.
Is thought to be perhaps something about their lifestyle.
True. The issue with that one is that it's kind of hard to rule out the genetic factors because it's so, they, you know,
it's
genetically they're a lot more distinct than the rest of the population. But yeah, I mean, there is amazing work coming both from animal but also human studies from the autism spectrum disorder and the microbiome that really, to me, at the beginning I didn't believe them, but now it's almost it would be unscientific not to take that evidence and understand that yes, the microbiome has a role in autism as well.
There's a study, I believe, that was recently completed that suggests that one of the approaches to dealing with autism might be via fecal transfer. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's correct. So yeah, this is a study that was done in Arizona, and it wasn't a really big group of patients, but it was, so basically what they did is that they exposed autistic children to antibiotics, and then they gave them fecal transplants. It was a pretty heavy therapy when it comes to fecal transplants, what they did here, because they gave them, I think it was daily or biweekly for about 8 weeks. And then they measure different things, from gastrointestinal symptoms and also behavioral responses. And what they found a couple of months after was that there were improvements both in the GI or the gastrointestinal symptoms, but also in the behavioral or the neurological symptoms associated with autism. So there was improvement there. So that was one of the recent breakthroughs. And of course, there's now several clinical trials happening in the U.S. Right now with autistic children because of that study.
Hmm. Hence, a chapter in your book, Let Them Eat Dirt, is entitled Bugs as Drugs. Well, what does the future hold? Is that a realistic prospect?
We see it. I mean, not just from the robustness of the science that is coming out, but the interest, the economic interest, too. So there's been a lot of pharmaceutical companies that have popped up because of the microbiome. So these are microbiome-specific companies, you know, San Francisco and Boston and London and in Montreal and the big hubs of biotech around the world. There's a lot of investment in trying to figure out which are the new age probiotics, which are the new bacteria.
Exactly, like, the ones. Frequent urinary tract infections in women, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, perhaps autism,
exactly.
Perhaps even
asthma.
Weight loss applications.
Yeah, so there's a lot of investment right now. So we'll see. I think in the next 10 years, we will know for sure if actual therapies come out of this. Manipulating the microbiome is not easy, and we don't know a ton about it anymore. I mean, as of yet, but this is changing. I mean, every year, it's been only a decade, and we went from only observational studies exactly in 2007 showing that you know, fat mice had different microbiomes than lean mice, to literally doing clinical trial in autistic children. So it is very fast-paced, and I think in about 10 years we'll know a lot more.
Another interesting implication of this, you discuss the work of some Israeli researchers who have tried to link the composition of the microbiome to people's reaction to certain foods. What we've discovered is the glycemic index isn't fixed. Some people's response to certain foods is sky-high blood sugar, and other people tolerate those foods, whereas other foods are the triggers for high blood sugar responses. And it's all based on a profile of their intestinal flora. And
that's
so
right.
Personalized diets.
Personalized
eat
nutrition.
This, don't eat that, based on your microbiome.
And what I've heard is that the company that came out from these scientists and some other venture capitalists out of Israel is doing really well too. So yeah, it makes sense that this is going to be very popular.
Mm-hmm. Also, how do you get a handle on your microbiome? Let's say you want to evaluate your microbiome in 2017. Are the tests ready for prime time? Are stool tests available? Or, as you discuss in the book, do urine tests reveal something about the microbiome?
Well, there are fecal tests now readily available, and there's a few companies out of the U.S. and other places where you can do this. So the technological aspect is there, and it's not expensive. It will probably cost you about $80 to $100. Mm-hmm. The problem is what to do with this information.
Yep.
We really know very little. What does it mean if your Prevotella is high? We don't really have normal ranges the same way we do when we go and get our blood test done. So it's early to do it.
I mean, is how do you change it? Because merely by taking a probiotic pill by mouth doesn't necessarily mean it will flourish and proliferate in your gut.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Maybe it's about diet, maybe it's about genetics, maybe it's about myriad factors that, you know,
exactly,
all need to be addressed.
Yeah. So for me, I did it out of curiosity because this is my field, knowing very well that there's really not much I can do about it.
Right. Yeah, because there's a little bit of genetic programming of your microbiome. And as you said, earlier, some of it's programmed by your exposure during birth, and some of it's programmed by your exposure to breast milk, and some of it's programmed by your previous diet.
That's right. Exactly. And what your mom did during pregnancy. I mean, yeah, there's just things that are really hard to overcome when it comes to manipulating your microbiome. But as we learn more, we may be able to find more commonalities in between individuals, and we may be able to focus not necessarily on the identity of the organisms, but the products that they make. So we may look at metabolic outputs of the microbiome, and it may be easier to understand and to possibly modify that than the actual bugs. But it's still quite early, I think.
In your book, you also talk a little bit about proper timing for introduction of gluten. You know, for a lot of people, gluten is a problem. There's a high incidence of celiac disease. There's a high incidence of non-celiac gluten intolerance. What can you do to make your kid gluten tolerant, you know, providing you want to do that? I mean, some people go to the extreme of trying to exclude it, but that's not a very practical measure. For a kid who's going to be independent, going to be an adolescent and go to college and so on and have exposure to these things.
Yes, and we added one study there on gluten, but there's been a few more coming out. The jury is not out on gluten, especially because there isn't huge evidence showing that you know, adding it early is going to result in a sensitivity. So it's hard to give a recommendation. Right now, the current recommendation is to introduce it just as you introduce other foods. It went from being introduced at 1 year. Now they're tending to group it with the allergenic ones and just saying introduce them at 4 to 7 months. So for now, we'll go with that. But I think this is something that might change in the near future. Just like, you know, these recommendations to when introduce foods, they just keep changing. It seems like every 3 to 5 years.
Right. And as we gain more insight through the work of researchers like yourself. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine take-home message? First of all, get the book, Let Them Eat Dirt. Do you have a website also that talks about your work?
That is, yeah, it is at letthemeatdirt.com. Really, the prime message here is to take care of your microbes and to read more about it. This is not something intuitive, even for microbiologists like myself. I mean, we've been really focused on studying disease-causing microbes for centuries. So this is new. The fact that most people do not know this, it's only natural. So inform yourself a bit more. There's a lot of resources. In our website, we have resources for parents and for kids. There's Q&As. And really try to put some of these things into practice as early as you can.
And finally, here's a review of your book from William Sears, who's very well-known co-author of The Baby Book, one of the most popular books around on childhood health. He writes, quote, a must-read for parents, teachers, and any healthcare provider for children. Let Them Eat Dirt takes you inside a child's gut and shows you how to give kids the best immune start early in life. So parents, grandparents, an essential resource. And I want to thank you and congratulate you, Dr. Marie-Claire Arrieta, on your research.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hoffman. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.